Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 17, Lawyers Gone Wild on a Lionel Train.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcasts.com/TWiL. And by GoToMeeting. For a month of unlimited online meetings, absolutely free, go to GoToMeeting.com/TWiL. We'd like to thank Victor Cajau for help with this podcast. You can listen to Victor's own podcast, The Typical Mac User, at TypicalMacUser.com.
Hi, this is Denise Howell, and I'm your host for This Week in Law, where we examine the impact of the law on your digital life. We're here today with some regulars of our panel, or folks that are becoming regulars. Evan Brown is here from Internet Cases. Evan, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And Colette Vogel is here from Vogel Law.
Hi.
Hi, Colette.
Hi.
Great to have you back. And Ernie Svensson from Ernie the Attorney.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Thanks, you guys. We were just talking offline about the last show, and we got great feedback, and we're thrilled to have Evan joining us again here. And also, I've been looking forward to catching up with you, Colette, and finding out how the, now is it the Portable Media Expo, the New Media Expo? What are we calling it this year?
This year, it was called the New Media Expo.
New Media Expo. Hot off your return from there, correct? Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Just this last weekend?
It was. It was quite different because it was moved to Vegas from its former home in Orange County. So that kind of changed the feel a little, but it was really great to see so many of the same faces and meet some new people who've started doing things in the space. So,
right. So give us the highlights.
The highlights. Well, I think the panel on law was critically acclaimed. No, I presented with Jeffrey Hermes of Brown Rudnick, who you know from last year, is doing this panel, Denise. And we had a full house. It was late in the afternoon on Friday. And the room, I'm really bad at guessing numbers, but it was completely full and went over like a half an hour longer than it should have because it was the last panel of the day. Because we've got, as you know, all those questions that people love to throw our way. It's a sort of hypothetical fest. The show otherwise, I mean, it had the exhibit floor was about the same size as last year. Some of the familiar faces were there, Wizard Media and a bunch of the different microphone companies and different companies doing services around new media. The only problem I had was feeling as closely knit with everyone because everybody kind of got spread out at after hours. You know, you just end up in different places in Las Vegas and in Orange County, you kind of all ended up in the same two or three bars. So that was very different in feel. But
what hotel were you at?
It was the Las Vegas Hilton, which is connected to the Las Vegas Convention Center. It's a little bit off the strip. My hotel room, I'm going to gripe, had cold water, so I moved to a different hotel. I was not happy, but...
Although I guess when you're in Vegas in August, cold water can be sort of a blessing.
That's true. But it was, you know, overall, the hotel was actually a good size for the group and had some decent places to kind of meet up and hang out and talk to people. So that was good. And the keynotes were very good. I saw the one on Sunday morning, Zaddy Diaz, and talking about their experiences was really fun.
Great. Was there any sort of key issue on the legal panel that you guys chewed on for a while, or were you bouncing back and forth between topics?
We bounced a little bit. We did it a little more presentation style this year, more like a workshop. And Jeffrey spoke about sort of all the ins and outs of defamation law and what to look out for as a producer. And then he also touched on Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act and a little bit on right of publicity. And then I did a presentation on general copyright principles and trademark issues, and then also touched on DMCA compliance. And the reason this year we brought in Section 230 and DMCA compliance is because we're finding more and more people, and this audience proved true of that, are doing hosting to some extent. You know, either, you know, a lot of people accept comments. That's nothing new. But other people are doing social networking things or using Ning and other services to allow other people to post content to their home pages or their websites, and they're, you know, related to their podcasting or blogging. And we wanted to put people sort of on notice of all of these laws out there that they could rely on for protection from liability for third-party content. So that was kind of new this year.
So the scenario you were addressing then was someone who has, you know, the look and feel of their regular site, but they're using some third-party service to host a more interactive component?
Yeah, that's one scenario. We asked the audience if anyone lets third parties post content to their site. And there were people in there who weren't just the podcasters themselves. There were people in the audience who were hosting services, essentially, and services allowing for content to be held by them and posted to. And I'm kind of blanking on any examples. Nobody asked a specific question, I don't think, about this. But when we asked the audience if people were hosting other people's content, you know, number of hands went up. And if they were using social networking services to have that community feel to their content, you know, they can take advantage in those cases of some of the Section 230 protections. And also, if they're compliant with the DMCA, then they can take advantage of, you know, any sort of takedown situation and know how to respond to that.
Right. I can see us getting to a point where who you send your DMCA compliance request to gets a little bit iffy.
Yeah. Like if you're using Ning or a service like that to host your social network, yeah, you need to be clear in your filing with the Copyright Office, you know, where to send, who your DMCA agent is and where to send that notice. Mm-hmm. And then Ning probably has some questions themselves of, you know, maintaining their neutrality and non-liability, hopefully.
Right. And you could see that coming into play, not just with, you know, social media kind of conversational aspects, but other kinds of rich media like photos and videos.
Exactly. Exactly. Like you could have a Flickr link on your site where your other people's photos are being pulled in, you know, in a queue kind of scrolling through your homepage or some part of your, you know, the layout of your site. And I don't, you know, I can see there might be times where the content might end up being infringing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
I think,
go ahead.
Well, I think that's great that you gave some emphasis to Section 230 as well, just based on my experience in the marketplace, so to speak. You know, for as long as I've been blogging and talking, you know, I've always kind of, you know, been very interested in Section 230 and tried to think of its natural implications. And then there's, of course, you know, the case law that's interesting to read. But it really seems like in just maybe since the beginning of 2003, I've gotten so many more calls where people are getting threatening letters from some people saying that they're being defamed through, you know, some service that the person calling me is providing. And so it's interesting to see. And it's a natural thing that we would suspect would happen with, you know, you mentioned Ning and, you know, platforms that allow people to become hosts. It's interesting to see that in reality, these issues are becoming more commonplace and that you're actually seeing them in the wild rather than just in some kind of academic setting like a blog post or speaking at a conference or something.
You've talked about Section 230 on the show before, but just in case somebody's listening who's not familiar with how that works, Evan, could you describe it real briefly for us?
Well, sure. It's Section 230, which is part of the Communications Decency Act, and it's at 47 U.S.C. Section 230. And at Section 230, Section 230C, C1, and C2, there are a couple of different provisions that go to or deal with the liability of an interactive computer service provider or a user of those services. But really the context is you know, mostly in connection with the provider of an interactive computer service. Section C1 provides that, or it says that no provider of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher of content or information that's provided by a third party. So courts, in large part, have read that that provision to grant pretty robust immunity to providers, hosts, for liability that would stem from the content that's put on their system by someone else. Say, for example, you're a forum board operator and a couple of your users get into it and end up defaming one another. Well, Section 230C1 provides, most courts have held, that provides immunity. You can't go after the forum board operator for like a cause of action for defamation, because one of the elements of that case would be publication, and you can't treat the operator as a publisher. Section C2 really is kind of the Good Samaritan provision. The whole 230C is all called the Good Samaritan provision, but C2 talks about how the operator of the interactive computer service can't be liable for any good faith efforts in removing content that he or she finds offensive. Say, for example, you're a hosting company and you find that somebody's putting sexually explicit material and you think that doesn't comport with the sensibilities of the people who are visiting your service, you can take that off and not have any liability to the user that you, in essence, might be censoring. So that's Section 230 in a nutshell. It provides for this broad immunity.
Yeah, I have been paying close attention to Section 230 over the last few years as technologies continue to expand and be used in new and different ways for people to communicate. And I'm real interested in, things that are going to be considered interactive computer services that you might not at first blush consider that way. Like, I haven't seen any cases. I'm wondering if any of you guys have that have considered podcasting in this context.
No, I haven't seen any, but Colette, I know you watch that space closer than anyone on the planet.
Yeah, I know of nothing. I've looked for cases showing, it's not very recently. It was probably about 6 months ago. I looked for the, word podcast appearing in civil complaints. It was hard to find anything filed that had that word. But
right, because more people, I think people who think about podcasts probably at first think of it more of a radio medium or a television medium if it's a video kind of production. But what you're doing is using the internet to communicate. So I think it's a real kind of strange area there. And I also think it's, once you start getting into, okay, we're going to put some third-party content on our show, audio or video, and we're just going to drop it in, you could do it in a number of ways. You could just drop it in and let it play and let the chips fall where they may, and then potentially subject yourself to liability for something that some third party said that you didn't screen before. Or if you are screening and make a decision to leave it in anyway, are you then becoming complicit so as to take yourself, into one of the exceptions to Section 230 as opposed to the immunity that it provides?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think there's some interesting issues with Section 230 and someone who's doing an interview. And it kind of, I think, mirrors a little bit of the law of defamation. Like this might be a little bit of a stretch, but let me throw it out there. So in an interview, you ask kind of an open-ended question and somebody responds to your interview and ends up on your podcast and you have no idea, but apparently they've completely lied or said something completely false. But you didn't encourage or elicit that particular response. You asked a pretty broad or open question and you got something, from that person. Now, is that, you're acting as an interactive computer service for purposes of Section 230, are you protected for that third party's commentary that ended up in your podcast? And I think there's room for debate on that. And especially after roommates, though, you could read the roommate's decision, very narrowly to those facts of having forms that force certain responses.
Right. That was the case that had to do with drop-down menus that asked people to make categorizations that were against California's fair housing laws.
Right.
Yeah, it was the federal act, too. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think there's some interesting play there that could happen where you may lose your role as interactive computer service under Section 230, and you may end up being officially the publisher of that comment, even though, you know, it wasn't something you expressly elicited. So,
yeah, I think the roommates.com case is instructive in that. And also, if you go back, 5 years to the Carafano versus Metro Splash case, I mean, even though those cases kind of are factually similar in that they deal with information that's provided, like by filling out a form on a website, Roommates, you know, didn't overrule Carafano. And, you know, I think what's really kind of a touchstone in this is the nature of the way that you elicit information from the user. So if, you know, clearly a situation in a podcast where you say, tell me something defamatory about, you know, this guy that you know, Joe Smith, I mean, clearly you're going to be more into the form of conduct that's that takes you out of the immunity under roommates.com. But if you were to say something, and I'm just speculating on this, if you say something like, tell me all that you know about your friend Joe Smith, there might be a distinction to be drawn there, you know, in the nature of the information that you're trying to elicit.
So it depends on whether you're conducting a Chelsea Lately type interview or a Tom Brokaw one.
Right.
Hey, speaking of Chelsea Lately and the intersection of that and our worlds, if any of you has to run to go off to the Girls Gone Wild press conference that started this morning, you know, I hate to keep you from that, but I did get that in my email that they're having their press conference about some settlement that they entered into in Florida that they claim they were coerced into a jail cell or in a jail cell.
Right. So you're talking about the Panama City beach.
Yes.
You know, I went to Panama City Beach in spring break when I was in high school, and this would have been in the early 90s, and it just sounds like things have gotten a lot better since then.
I don't know. I've never been.
What a place.
Yeah. Sounds I don't know, but I just think it's so funny, you know, I mean, you talk about difficulty of putting things into distinct buckets. The things that come through my email that people think that I might be interested in partaking of just caused me no end of humor, and that was one of them from this week.
Well, it can be entertaining to you at least, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's interesting. I'm not familiar with the facts of the case, but I read the little blurb you sent on the links for the episode that we're talking about. And it has to do with a woman who was apparently 16 years old when she was filmed flashing her breast in 2002. And that picture was on the cover of something. And there's laws, criminal laws in the porn industry about record keeping regarding the ages of people who appear in pornography. It's section 2257. I forget the, is it 18 USC 2257?
Yeah, title 18.
Yeah. And so this is an interesting thing because I actually had to look into this recently, whether there's a civil cause of action under that section. And I think, at least some of the stuff I've looked at, suggests that there probably is not, because the Congress didn't expressly include a civil cause of action. But, I mean, I wonder, if this person would have, if the government could have gone after the Girls Gone Wild folks for that, for a criminal violation if they didn't keep proper records under 2257. It's just something that crosses my mind. I don't know if Congress will amend that. They seem to always like to go after the porn industry for a lot of things.
Right. It's always the record-keeping stuff that gets people in trouble, you know.
Yeah, that was our last year.
Al Capone could tell you about that, too.
Well, and I suppose I don't know if a right of publicity claim would fly because the person probably wasn't famous until she actually had herself exposed by Girls Gone Wild.
I think there are other possible claims. Well, if she did it all in public, there's all that question about, well, what was her reasonable expectation in that scenario?
How do you have a reasonable expectation when you're drunk out of your mind?
In 2002, and you don't know. I mean, it looks like it was on the cover of something, but who knows, it could end up anywhere on the internet today.
Right. Well, since we're talking about minors and the law, another link in our list there was a case that's pending now in Texas. I think it's called Maverick versus Harper. That is, one of these RIAA cases. And there's actually some language from the judge there that looks like the judge might be inclined to go ahead and let the defendant have a damage cap instead of the $750 per infringement that has typically been applying in these cases, that the judge might be inclined to exercise discretion to lower it to $200 per infringement because the person was a minor and claims they didn't know, you know, what file sharing software did and that there would be any illegal material there.
She thought Kazaa worked like the radio or something like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's plausible.
Right.
But yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting that there could be this innocent infringement defense that could come into play and start lowering the damages in those cases. Just another sort of move on the chessboard there in that ecosystem.
Well, you know, in any ecosystem, the more diversity you have, the more robust the life forms will be. So given the fact that there's however many thousands of suits that the RIAA has filed, that we have plenty of opportunities for there to be, you know, arguments like this raised. And you wonder how much it is, you know, the court buying into this argument of innocent infringement just to kind of temper the overall situation in terms of equity when the hands may be tied, so to speak, on the question of liability, you know, trying to reduce the damages just to make it overall, you know, more fair.
Yeah, it sounds like a little bit of that could definitely be coming into play. The commentary I read, and this is the story that's in our show notes, had the judge saying that, you know, the law is not intending to be overly punitive. So it sounds like the judge is trying to make some kind of accommodation that's not there in the statute.
Right.
But I mean, they do have the discretion to lower damages. So exercising that discretion is within his or her discretion, I guess.
Well, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Clearly, if there's any facts at all that the judge can hang his hat on about, you know, this question of the copyright notice.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, I apologize to you guys for my cold. I'm having like the worst podcasting voice day at the moment, but I'll try not to infect you all as we go through the show.
Skype's not that good yet.
Yeah, stay well clear of the mic back here. So one other thing that I thought was kind of interesting that came across the transom lately is, I guess the EFF is going to step in and or has stepped in and is helping someone who got caught up in a, you know, one of the routine universal sweeping takedown barrages to YouTube that was this time targeting material that was in Prince's publication library. And this is now Stephanie Lenz versus Universal. Stephanie Lenz, I guess, was a mom who took a quick video of her child dancing away to Let's Go Crazy, you know, grainy little video taken with her digital camera that had just a snippet of the song that was caught in one of these DMCA takedown kind of barrages. And Stephanie Lenz, I don't know, you know, what her proclivities were, because most people, I think, if they had their little YouTube video taken down, would probably not raise a big ruckus, but she somehow got linked up with the EFF and is fighting this and has filed a suit to have declaratory relief as to whether or not her use was fair use. What do you guys think of all that and where we're going with this sort of thing?
I'll give a shot at it here. I mean, there's one of the other items that we may be discussing today is this notion of, you know, what it means to infringe on a sound recording. And, you know, it's a different context that we have a link here talking about that New York State case. And that's about, you know, a common law copyright in the sound recording. But one of the points in that case is this notion of the Sixth Circuit decision in Bridgeport versus Dimension Films, which really draws a very bright line that there essentially is no such thing as fair use when it comes to sampling one's work. So if anything, it's good that we have this opportunity, I guess, in a different jurisdiction outside of the Sixth Circuit to maybe get some clarity on this question of whether there is such a thing as a de minimis exception to copyright infringement when it's, you know, for a sound recording, or alternatively, whether, you know, I think it, more in line with common sense, there could be a fair use affirmative defense to copyright infringement in the case of a sound recording, you know, just a little snippet of it.
Right. I don't know that this case is a really good test case for an exception to the sampling rule that came out of the sixth, because I think it used the cases around that have gone down to half seconds and seconds and really just a tiny bit of the recording. And this, I think, used enough that you could recognize the song.
Sure. But still, you know, its use is transformative. It's not there to,
right,
not there to entertain you in the way that Prince, you know, remarkably can entertain you, but it's there to provide the backdrop for, oh, look at this cute child, you know, dancing away.
Yeah, I think they're focusing more on the fact that it's not impacting the market for Prince's works. And I think,
right, there are plenty of things to talk you out of buying Prince's work in the first place. Just add to it.
Well, I just wanted to flag that in that article you linked to, Denise, that it sounds like that's the market impact prong of the fair use test, so the fourth element of that test, is one that EFF might be strongly trying to play on here, and that the article quotes Corinne McSherry, who's one of the EFF lawyers, and she says, there must be some requirement that a copyright owner both consider fair uses and determine honestly whether they exist before sending their takedown notice. And then she said the video, which focuses on the toddler, contains only a snippet of the song, couldn't have any conceivable impact on the market Universal's copyright was meant to protect. So the question is, what is the market that the copyright is supposed to protect? And does that include these kinds of short videos put up on YouTube? I haven't seen the video, so unfortunately, I don't know how long it is. It might say in here somewhere, but I mean, that Bridgeport case
says 29 seconds.
29 seconds, okay. And the song, I would imagine, is a couple minutes long at least. I find music to be really frustrating because I kind of, that Bridgeport case is a, you know, not a great case for a lot of reasons. And if you try to counsel somebody on using clips of music in anything, I always use that case as an example, and then I use the Pretty Woman case that went to the Supreme Court, where taking the entire song because it was a parody was okay. And then just last week we have the case of using the case that the Fair Use Project won, essentially, on a preliminary injunction ruling about using, I think it was 15 seconds of the Imagine song, the Beatles song Imagine, in a documentary that clearly is commercially, you know, being used commercially, and that was okay. So you have all these different opinions within the realm of using music, and it all comes down to how you work out the fair use facts, the factual context of the fair use test. And it's really, really, really hard to tell a client, and I've never been able to, frankly, that yes, that's clearly a fair use. You're good. Go for it. You know, no risk. So.
Isn't there a procedural twist, though, here? Because, I mean, there is one, because what's happening in this case is that the woman who had her 29-second video taken down is suing the entertainment company.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Section 512F thing, right, for misrepresenting ownership when they sent the DMCA takedown notice. Isn't that right?
I don't know. But it's unusual to have it turn out this way. Usually it's the, Universal would be going against somebody for posting something that infringed their copyright. But here, they took the action. YouTube took it down. Then after, I guess, 2 weeks or so, they put it back up, and the plaintiff is saying you shouldn't have taken it down at all. What are the damages for that?
I think they're just seeking sort of a declaratory statement from the court.
Well, under Section 512F, if you are the party issuing the takedown notice and you don't do it with good faith, or you don't, I have to look up the actual language of the statute, you run the risk that if you've sent a takedown letter that is inappropriate, you're on the hook. Certainly for declaratory relief, but I think other relief, and that's exactly...
Yeah, that's true. You have to...
Fees. And that's how, in the Diebold case that involved the voting machine issue, and this is now several years ago, but pretty sure EFF was involved in that, and I know Stanford had been. The students had taken emails from Diebold and published them that admitted that there were problems with their voting machines, and so Diebold claimed copyright over the emails that were published. And then the students brought a 512F action saying, no, you can't do that. That's wrong. And then they did win their attorney's fees, and it was, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. So yeah, there is a risk when you send your takedown notice, for sure.
Yeah, especially when you do just a blanket barrage of everything without actually considering whether there's some kind of fair use defense that could legitimately apply.
I'm looking at the statute here, and it says, well, I'll just summarize it. It's a knowing material misrepresentation that that the activity is infringing. So if you send the DMCA takedown notice, you know, with making a knowingly material misrepresentation that it's infringing, like whether you own the content, the copyright in it or not, and you can get damages, costs, and attorney's fees, you know, if you're the alleged infringer that and you turn out to be okay. And just to add something, I mean, this standard, this knowing material misrepresentation, is a subjective standard. So it depends on, you know, what the person actually sending the takedown notice thinks, you know, when he or she sends it. That's the Rossi case from a couple of years ago.
Well, here in the description, it says that Universal ordered YouTube to remove the video and nearly 200 others involving compositions by Prince. So, I mean, is it relevant for Universal to say, look, it's not like we went after this one video. I mean, we're in good faith, and we didn't, you know, maybe it was determined that this one wasn't, you know, sufficient infringement and there was fair use. But I mean, when they're scrambling to get a lot of stuff off of YouTube, which is what I gather goes on, it seems to me that a judge would be receptive and not inclined to award damages if YouTube says, well, look, you know, okay, we made a mistake with this one, but it wasn't like we singled this one out. This was part of an overall effort that we made.
I tend to agree because of that whole subjective standard. And, you know, clearly it is actually Prince's music, and, you know, it's it is a colorable claim of infringement in the first instance there. Others may disagree, but I kind of line up behind you there, Ernie, saying that the court would probably not come down too hard on in a situation like this.
Well, let me take, for devil's advocate's case, you know, the other side of that. You know, individuals like her are, you know, end up having to, you know, obtain legal advice to respond and deal with these things. I mean, maybe it's certainly a choice if it's worth it to her to fight it or not. But why shouldn't the party who sends the inappropriate takedown notice be responsible for at least those attorney's fees in responding?
Well, they would be. I mean, but the standard is a knowingly material misrepresentation. You can't just have people going around paying everybody else's attorney's fees all the time when there actually is, you know, a colorable claim. I mean, I see both sides of it, but, you know, we've got to
draw the line. They actually looked at the video. I mean, I think they probably ran an algorithm looking for some, you know, they probably hired some company out there, which is what I think they do, to go look for stuff and then send it to their lawyers, and the lawyers send out these letters and don't stop long enough to actually look at what they're sending the letter about. I mean, somebody's got to take the responsibility to look at the content before the takedown letter gets sent.
Sure, sure, of course. And I don't disagree with that. But, you know, in this situation, if they, you know, put a human on the job, so to speak, after having an algorithm identify it, I mean, what would that human find? Well, in fact, they would find 29 seconds of, you know, a reproduction of the actual sound recording in which they own the copyright. So, you know, obviously it's a close case.
And then the other layer to it, although, you know, I don't think it came up here, but it certainly will come up for YouTube in similar contexts probably, is, you know, YouTube is starting to put ads in these videos as opposed to just ads on their site, which is already causing them enough trouble. But, right, you know, for them, again, algorithmically to go through and plunk ads into videos, maybe there's something that would weed out something that has potentially infringing material. It's probably something that they're going to have to work on. But you wind up with the Grokster problem for YouTube under those circumstances. And, of course, its case with Viacom is all about that.
Right. And for DMCA, you have the whole red flag knowledge problem. You know, if YouTube knows more, the more they know about what's possibly in all these videos that are being uploaded, then they could be on the hook for actual knowledge, and they can't rely on DMCA protection if that's what they're hoping to rely on.
Right, and with your point of putting ads in the advertisement, I mean, that would seem to bolster a case, you know, on a theory of contributory, or in any kind of secondary theory of liability that the revenues are derived directly from the infringing activity. So problematic on a couple different points.
Yeah. Colette, I want to get to the couple of cases. The one you mentioned, the Imagine case and the Lionel Train case that you had emailed me about in a second here. But I wanted to do a quick sponsorship break for us. We have a new sponsor that is GoToMeeting, and being lawyers all, I'm wondering, have any of you used this service yet?
Oh, absolutely. It's great.
Yes, I have. It is good.
Good. Well, if you don't already have accounts and you'd like to do a 30-day free trial, this applies to everyone listening to the podcast, you can go to gotomeeting.com/twill and you'll get a 30-day free trial of the service with unlimited meetings, and you can try it out yourself and kick the tires. It's basically a way that you can meet with someone and share a computer screen. And the first time I ever saw it demoed was when Buzz Brueggemann showed me the ActiveWords software, Ernie, which I'm sure you probably had the similar experience with Buzz.
Yeah, he actually appears in my dreams to do demos.
Sometime back in 2004 was the first time I'd ever used this service, and he got me on the phone at the office and walked me through his product, and it's super effective for something like that, and I could see it being really useful for anybody who needs to collaborate on a document or can't make the cross-country trip to give a presentation. This is a great way to do it. So we thank GoToMeeting for sponsoring the show, and I encourage you guys to take advantage of the 30-day free trial and give the service a try and let us know what you think.
So it would allow you to do more work from Panama City Beach, Florida, if you wanted to.
That's true. Or from Panama. Isn't that where you went recently, Ernie?
Yes. I didn't test that when I was in Panama. I think I need to go back and do a trial run.
Absolutely. See how much you can actually get done from your Panamanium office.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll work, but I do need to test it.
Yeah.
Right.
So, Colette, why don't you bring us up to speed on the Stanford Fair Use Project's victory in that Imagine case?
Oh, yeah. No, this is the facts here are really interesting. Just to be clear, I don't work on this. I'm just like a non-resident fellow down there, and so I get to, you know, follow what they're doing sometimes a little more closely. But the case involves this film called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, and it's a film that has to do with the intelligent design debate about, you know, teaching intelligent design in schools. And it's apparently critical of the fact that offering evidence that proponents of intelligent design are being unfairly criticized, censored, and expelled from public schools and universities and other forums. And it's narrated by Ben Stein, and it's got pretty, it's apparently a very well-made documentary. And part of the documentary discusses the question of religion, not surprisingly, and has some commentators going back and forth about whether religion, you know, is sort of potentially the cause of the problems. And it has some detail. I haven't seen the film, but from the case and reading the opinions, it's apparent that there's a discussion about a world without religion. And at that point in the documentary, the narrator, Ben Stein, moves, says something along the lines of, this is the world that the Beatles envisioned, or John Lennon envisioned, and then it goes into a 15-second clip of the song Imagine, and sort of takes the most recognizable section of that song and the lyrics that has to do with a world without religion. The people who produced the film were sued both in state court and I think in federal. I'm still not fully clear on all the procedural stuff, but there's a state court opinion that came out, and then very shortly thereafter, a federal opinion, and both were on the question of, it was a preliminary injunction opinion, and whether the EMI Records and the Lennons can enjoin this film from being distributed because of the alleged infringing use of this clip in the song. And Both courts, the New York court and the federal court, said this is a clear case of fair use and applied the same four-factor test. And what's so interesting to me is this is, I think, the first time since the Naxos decision that acknowledged a state-based copyright in sound recordings Naxos recognized a state-based copyright, common law copyright claim for sound recordings prior to February 15th, 1972. And that, previous to that opinion a few years ago, wasn't really acknowledged by any court. So this is the first case from New York applying common law copyright, because this sound recording, I believe, was from 1971. And so the court, it was unclear, you know, what's the standard for fair use? Does it even exist under New York common law, and what's the standard? And the judge effectively said that the standard, it does exist. It's part of the free speech, important free speech rights, and applied essentially the exact same test you would apply in a federal case, the four-factor test, and looking primarily at, is this a transformative use? How much was taken? Was it more than necessary? And to make the transformative use, and was there an effect on the market and that kind of thing? And in both cases, they came out suggesting or opining that there was a clear fair use here, and it was very transformative, and that at least at this stage of the litigation, no injunction would issue.
Great, that's wonderful news. Did the documentary film project get involved in this one too?
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
Yes, that was the fair use. The documentary film project, I think, is. Oh, you know what? Actually, I don't know the answer to that, because that project is about insurance,
right?
And I don't know if they were part of that process, if they got insurance first through being kind of pre-screened, and then, you know, were able to distribute their film, and then got sued, and then fair use project stepped in to defend. I don't know that.
Yes, Brandy Carl, who is working with the Fair Use Project, begged off for today. She's far too busy, unfortunately, but I'd love to have her on the show sometime. She's one of my favorite bloggers. She used to blog at Who Stole the Tarts and has been blogging for quite some time. And so someday soon we're going to have her on the show, and maybe she can answer that question for us. So tell us about something that's been near and dear to my heart for the last several years, anyway, with a young boy in the house, this Lionel Train case.
Okay. I have to be completely honest. I haven't read this opinion cover to cover. I've skimmed it pretty quickly. I was the Lionel Train case has to do with, I believe, so it's sort of software dealing with train switching stuff for the train sets. I guess somebody created a competing train software for the switch. At any rate, the one thing that really intrigued me was very geeky procedural matter. Like, why is the Federal Circuit, you know, writing this extensive copyright opinion from a case that came from the Northern District of California? Normally, a copyright case would be appealed to the Ninth Circuit, but there was a patent claim pending, and that's how it ended up in the Federal Circuit's hands. And the gist of the opinion, or I guess the gist of what people were fighting about in part, was whether these open source licenses, because you're giving away some rights and you're giving things away for free, you're not charging, whether that's if that just obviates any copyright claim that you can later bring. And the court said that the lack of money changing hands in open source licensing should not be presumed to mean that there's no economic consideration. And I think that that was sort of a key issue in the case. And then the court went on to talk somewhat about Creative Commons licensing, because they were had filed an amicus brief, and essentially held that the district court's opinion had to be overturned, and that these open source licenses were valid and needed to be respected. So open source is sort of probably not the best, most precise way to describe them, because there's so many different kinds of licenses like this, but sort of, I think the court's opinion uses the phrase the artistic license, and it was actually a Creative Commons license that I think was at issue, or you could argue that was the same.
It was an artistic license, which is a little bit different. It was I'm not sure it was a Creative Commons.
Okay.
But essentially,
are you familiar with this one, Evan?
Well, I've read it, and you know, really, it is. It's one of those cases where you read it the first time through and think, oh yeah, you know, that makes a lot of sense, and this is pretty straightforward. And you know, my gosh, you know, the district court judge was off his rocker when he wrote the opinion and all that. But when you get down to it and really start analyzing and thinking about it and trying to apply the principles of this case in real life, it gets pretty complicated. What I take from the case is something that is helpful really for drafting any kind of intellectual property license, in particular copyright license, and not just in the context of open source, because it underscores this distinction that comes from copyright law, or I'm sorry, from the law of contracts, contract law, this distinction between the breach of a covenant or the breach of a promise in an agreement or a breach of a condition. And depending on whether or not the defendant's conduct is a breach of a covenant or a breach of a condition, that sets forth or that determines the type of remedy or cause of action really that is available. You know, if it's merely a breach of a covenant or a breach of a promise, you know, for example, in a copyright license, the breach of the promise to pay royalties, any use of the copyrighted work, you know, in that situation would just give rise to a breach of contract and not an infringement case. But if it's a breach of a condition, something like, you know, exercising one of the exclusive rights under Section 106 of the Copyright Act outside of the grant of the license, then you've got a copyright infringement and a whole different cause of action and a whole new set of remedies. And given the fact that this was, you know, this free license, so to speak, you know, they talk about, you know, the court kind of goes in between talking about open source and there was another term that the court used for it, public license. That's it right there. Yeah, kind of obvious. It was complicated in this situation, and that whole analysis, this distinction between the breach of covenant and a breach of a condition, was muddied a little bit because of the what the district court referred to as the intentional breadth of the license grant. You know, you were free to do just about everything you wanted to do with the software, like, you know, make copies or even integrate it into a commercial product, so long as you do certain things like give the right to attribution, or, you know, give attribution and list the authors and link to the copyright holder's website. So you can see in that sense, it is an awful lot like a Creative Commons license.
So the license actually permitted commercial use?
Yes. Yes, it did. And, you know, but you just have to do certain things like, you know, make attribution and all that stuff. So what happened? The defendant did indeed integrate this into a commercial product, but didn't do all of those other things like give attribution, which sounds, you know, depending on how you look at it, in my mind, could go either way. That just sounds almost like a promise. You know, I promise to give you attribution if I use this in some commercial product. But if you just kind of engage in some semantics and say it another way, I, you know, in the position of the copyright holder, you know, you may use this provided that you give me attribution. It's really, really dicey and almost metaphysical, and depends on how you really want to approach it. It's a situation where a good advocate can make some arguments going either way.
Sure. And the added wrinkle is that, you know, we're not talking about a kind of a contract that is actually negotiated and signed by the parties. You know, a license simply applies, and if you make use of the work, then you're presumed to be bound by the license. But
yes, take it or leave it. And that goes back to what we were talking about the last episode, about these forms of agreements that are entered into at a distance without any kind of negotiation or arrangement.
Right. Yeah, and there's this interesting, I don't know, brain teaser that I run into is, you know, are the licenses like this, these public licenses or open source licenses or the Creative Commons ones, are they contracts? Do we apply ordinary contract law to them, or are they a sort of a default permission based on conditions? I guess this is exactly what this case is partly grappling with. And I think Evan's exactly right that there is a difference in certainly the remedies available, and in some cases whether you can even be in federal court, if it's viewed as a copyright infringement or a contract dispute.
Right. I mean, I remember in law school and, studying for the bar exam, it's relatively easy to, commit these types of things to rote memory, a breach of a promise, or a breach of a covenant will give you a right to, sue for a breach of contract, whereas a breach of a condition, you remember talk about, breaches of conditions precedent, breaches of conditions subsequent, all that stuff. I mean, those kind of blend into one, I think, in the licensing context. But, a breach of a condition is not a breach of the contract. It just kind of excuses performance. So in a situation like this, where licensors, copyright holders, are trying to be creative, and I say that in the generic sense and in the sense of creative commons, they're trying to do innovative things with putting works out there to be able to be appropriated by others, that really serves to make this an even dicier issue, which is, I think, the point I've been making here.
Hey, Colette, this is awfully late to be noting this, but I am noticing with your lack of a headset this go-round, we're getting some static on your end when you're not muted. So if you can mute when you're not talking, that will help matters, I think, for the listeners.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks a lot. Okay, the next thing I want to get to in just a second here after we do our other sponsorship break is the DVR case that just came down. But before we go there, I do want to thank Audible for sponsoring the show as well, and ask you guys if you have been listening to anything you'd like to recommend. Any books you're reading? Any fun stuff that is engaging you other than your various and busy practices?
I'm reading books on puppy care because I'm getting a puppy in a few weeks. I don't know if they're available on Audible. It'd be actually really nice if they were for me.
Well, let me check for you. I do have a recommendation for our listeners. And if you go to audible.com/twit, you can get a free book, which is a very good deal. And the book that I wanted to recommend, because we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of it, and it is such a seminal book that everyone should read or listen to if they have not yet done it. And that's The Clue Train Manifesto, which sent me down this new media sort of road many, many years ago, almost 10 years ago now. And it's what's amazing to me about the book is how well it holds up after almost a decade. I mean, they started with these 95 theses of how business was no longer going to be the same in a networked world. And you go through and you read the theses and you go, yep, that's still very true. And you see changes in that regard every single day. Here's number 12, just off the top of my head here. There are no secrets. The networked market knows more than companies do about their own products. And whether the news is good or bad, they tell everyone. So,
yep.
Just 95 of those little pearls of wisdom and all of the great commentary that the authors, Christopher Locke and Doc Searls and Rick Levine and David Weinberger, three of them, who are really well-known bloggers and scholars, alone make the book worth reading, and the combination really makes it a seminal work. So that's our Audible recommendation. And yes, Colette, there are Puppy's First Steps, Raising a Happy, Healthy, Well-Behaved Puppy.
Great.
By the faculty of the Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University. So
very good.
If any of you don't yet have an Audible account, go to audible.com/twit and you can get one of these wonderful books for free. It's such a great service. I use it in so many ways. I use it so much with my son when we go on long drives. The kids.audible.com has been terrific for that. And of course, when I've got time to myself on airplanes or at the gym, I'm using it as well. So I encourage you guys to do it too. And all the listeners, there are some 50,000 titles there available at Audible, and not all of them are books. There are great lectures and magazines and a slew of free podcast material too. So,
hey Denise,
yes,
have we recommended The Nine by Jeffrey Toobin?
We yet? Have. That has been one of our.
We
picks.
Should always recommend it every time.
I know my dad and my husband love that book. I gave it to both of them for Christmas last year, and I haven't read it myself yet. So you love it too.
Yeah, it's a great book if you're a lawyer, because it's kind of revisiting constitutional law. And my case, having graduated from law school more than 20 years ago, obviously a lot has happened since then. But he comes at the description of what the Supreme Court does by taking each justice and then kind of examining their personality and how they came to be on the court, and then you know, what their philosophy was both in and outside the court. For example, Justice Kennedy got interested in international law because he traveled to Europe a lot, and that seemed to have shaped his view of things. And it's just interesting to see how they, you know, how the justices change their worldview. And I think that the reason the book is so compelling is it's really a book that you can recommend people who are not lawyers, who don't really need to be a lawyer to get engaged by Jeffrey Toobin's very wonderful way of capturing events on the court. So that's why I think it's a great book. And there's a lot of there's a Google interview. You know how Google has those interviews with authors, and there's one of his interviews when he went to Google, and he talks about how he wrote the book and some background and so forth. And that's a good compliment to the book itself. But the book on Audible is read by Jeffrey Toobin. That's another important thing.
Yeah, I love it when authors read their own books. You really sort of get the feeling that you're getting their inflection and their emphasis on,
absolutely.
On how it comes across. So thanks again, Audible. We love you as a sponsor, and we're thrilled to have you as part of our Twill family. So have you guys looked at this Cartoon Network versus CSC Holdings case that is kind of a seminal ruling, it looks like, where it comes to DVRs and what DVRs are going to be permitted to do under the law? In a nutshell, it looks like this case went ahead and decided that you could have a networked DVR or a remote service. Cablevision was the cable company here that was trying to offer that service, and was sued by a number of entertainment industry plaintiffs, saying that no, this is actually the transmission of copyrighted works, that DVRs have to operate locally as a recording device. All Cablevision wants to do is give people DVR functionality on their cable box and then record everything off-site at their own server farm, which seems like it would be the ultimate inconvenience for all their customers, because they don't need to go out and have their cable boxes swapped out, etc. And the ultimate inconvenience for Cablevision, because it's just a software update on their end. But there was some question about whether they can do it, and I guess this case says, yep, go ahead, you can. Anybody have any thoughts or comments about it?
Well, I have a feeling that it may not be the last we hear from it. I don't know if the Supreme Court would be interested in this, but you know, the consequence of the ruling is that it essentially validates a brand new business model that just about everyone with a television might, you know, want to you know, become a part of. You know, this is on par technologically with, you know, the VCR. I mean, look how that changed our television viewing habits and our media consumption habits. And you know, this has a little bit for everyone. Denise, you were talking about the question of convenience. And one thing that I kind of wondered about is, you know, what would the cable company see that's so interesting or so compelling, you know, having all of this content that's being stored by its users in a central location as opposed to distributed out there in the, you know, set-top boxes of the individuals. And I imagine, and I'm just totally speculating on this, I've never talked with anybody who's involved with the situation, but I would imagine that there are opportunities, new opportunities for advertisement, or just at least gathering of metrics that the cable company would have by having this content stored up in one particular location. So in the sense that there's anything to exploit there, the ruling certainly is a positive development.
I read somewhere that the reason why the cable companies were excited about it was because there were technical issues and problems with delivering content to be stored or maintaining a DVR and the hard drive and troubleshooting it and then delivering it to the DVR, and that they would prefer a model that would cause, you know, that would pull from a central database, you know, which I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what
I
read.
That makes sense, and it also puts a lot of this, or it gives the chance to exploit some of this content, I guess, out there in the long tail, maybe a bit more easily. And maybe that's not a perfect example or perfect framework to fit it in, but what I'm trying to say is there could be much more content available on demand or being able to be stored when you don't have, you know, 100,000 or however many, I guess, millions of pieces of hardware out there that you would have to make sure are in good order, but you have one centralized place where all this hardware is. So maybe it would ease the delivery in that sense. That makes a lot of good sense there.
How does this play into the scenario where I remember a few years back, wasn't it mp3.com that was letting you stream your own or you could upload what your library of MP3s was, and then you could listen to it from anywhere. But really all they did was verify what you had, and then they had a copy, and then you could listen to, you know, your copy, and then that was shut down. Doesn't this sort of implicate that area and suggest that maybe that situation is changing as far as the legality of it?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because one of the things the plaintiffs raised was that, you know, this is essentially indistinguishable from an on-demand service for which they are paid royalties. But what the Cablevision argued instead was, and I think one of their representatives said this, it was no, in fact, it was not on-demand. It was simply a DVR with a very long cord.
Right.
And so, you know, I think they're kind of splitting hairs there in a way, because clearly they're going to have to maintain a vast central database of all of these shows and then deliver them up in an on-demand fashion based on what folks have chosen to quote-unquote record. So I do think they're sort of dancing a fine line there.
And, you know, fortunately they had other, you know, sides of the line to be on, because, you know, getting to actually what the opinion says, I mean, it was not an infringement, or, you know, it could not be an infringement by having this data stream coming into this buffer where there was only, you know, maybe 1.5 seconds of content at any given point. You know, that was not, that could not be an infringement, because it wasn't creating a copy of that content, because it wasn't being fixed in a tangible medium of expression for more than, you know, a mere transitory duration. So it's a good thing that they actually had the law and, you know, the decision on the merits of, or, well, I don't mean to say the decision on the merits, but the actual substantive elements of copyright to help them out on this.
Yeah. You guys remember that TV commercial that was for a hotel chain? It said, you pull up and imagine, it was kind of a dumpy little motel, and you pulled up and walked in the office, and they told you that they had every movie ever made,
right,
that you could watch at any time. And,
right,
you know, that was years and years ago. But I think, you know, we're getting to the point where instantaneous access to that kind of library is what people, in fact, are coming to expect. And how we're going to deliver it out to them is where it gets interesting.
Well, yeah, clearly this is a case that critics of the modern copyright framework can look to and say, you know, the modern technological context stretches copyright a little bit too far, you know, because of this whole notion of the part of the decision that asks whether or not this copy of the movie, or, you know, of the content, you know, a portion of the actual work only exists in a buffer for, you know, 1 second or so. I mean, the court's decision is, yes, it is embodied, even though it's not embodied, the whole work is not embodied at the same time, but that's still not a copy, because that embodiment is only for a transitory duration. I mean, that requires some, I mean, yeah, it makes sense to me, and it fits within the framework that we're given here in copyright. But, you know, it does take a little bit of mental gymnastics to get to that, to that the conclusion is that the work is embodied, but it's, you know, you can't, it's just kind of, it's just, there's no, there's nothing analogous here we're getting to some kind of fundamental notion of language, I guess. There's nothing analogous in the analog world. I mean, like a person or a – well, or let's just take examples of actual physical copyrightable works. You know, like a book, for example, cannot be embodied just one page at a time. I guess it could. You could print a page, burn it, print another page, burn that, or something like that. You know, a sculpture, a statue cannot be embodied just one portion at a time. You know, you can't have Michelangelo's David just exists, you know, for one point, you know, his hand would exist and then his head would exist. It's got to be all at once. It's just really does strain the one's imagination in thinking of these concepts, applying these concepts of copyright law, which were formulated and drafted in the analog world, and placing them into this very innovative method of distributing content through digital means.
If I could jump in, the one thing that I think, I think all of the comments you guys have had are really super interesting. I have two things that jump out at me when I'm looking at this opinion. One is that the plaintiffs didn't bring any sort of secondary liability theory. This whole opinion is about direct liability. And I think that was hugely instructive to the decision. And, you know, I'm really curious. I don't know all of the history on the case as to why they didn't bring any kind of contributory or vicarious liability.
Well, may I suggest just one word why they didn't, and that word is Sony.
But I think the other issue is, and I'm looking at a little piece of the opinion where they're talking about the question of who makes the copy. This is the volitional act doctrine again. Like, they're not using that language, but they're saying the Cablevision says basically that we're not making the copies. It's these users over here who push, you know, who set up the recording to take place, and then the recording takes place. So we're not. You know, copyright requires some volitional act by the infringer under direct infringement theories. And under direct infringement theories, in this case, the volitional actor is the person, the consumer, who's directing the copy to be made. So I think that's super interesting. Evan, do you think this is – what do you think this impact of this kind of an opinion is between looking at the Sony time-shifting analysis and – what I think we're going to see more of, which is place-shifting theories, things like Slingbox and other services that are offering place-shifting. Does this help them?
Well, I think that I don't know whether it would help them or not, but, I mean, clearly you've got to examine that issue of volition in order to make this fit into the Sony context. And just, you know, kind of way of background, what we're talking about here is the 1984 Supreme Court decision in the Sony case that held, you know, in so many words, that it was a non-infringing fair use to, say, for example, record a television show on a VHS tape. Well, actually, it was a Betamax tape, I guess. Using your VH or your VCR because it was a fair use to time shift. And so, what you're talking about is place shifting. There, I mean, I would think that if you can legitimate the technology itself, and by that I mean show that the actual purveyor of the technology is not getting into any trouble, whether it be through some theory of direct infringement, and that case seems to validate that point, or, you know, can fit safely outside of the constraints of Grokster. This is something that's not put into the marketplace with the intent that the users engage in direct copyright infringement, then, you know, that certainly can't hurt those evolving or, you know, those new emerging technologies that deal with time shifting. I almost said shape shifting, time shifting and place shifting, these devices that can allow you to use to watch your cable signal when you're vacationing in the Bahamas or something over the internet. So,
yeah. Or in Panama.
I'll as far as I can make it is Panama City Beach, so I'll work my way down to Panama one of these days.
Yeah, and then you're back to Ernie's MP3.com example where, you know, you have the locker in the sky and how that didn't fly. So I do think this will all be very interesting to watch, and, you know, because as far as the consumer's concerned, they don't care whether it's stored locally or not. They want to watch it when they want to watch it. We have a DVR at home. We use TiVos, but we have a DVR elsewhere that, you know, records and stores whatever is coming through the cable programming. And I, frankly, I have no idea whether it's recording it locally or in the cloud, and I could care less. But obviously it makes a difference from the copyright standpoint.
Right. I imagine money has something to do with it.
Hey, Denise, listen, I'm going to hop off because I got to pick up a child at school.
Great.
But I've enjoyed this as always, and look forward to the next one.
And we've enjoyed having you. You folks can find Ernie at ErnieTheAttorney.net and your Ernie Attorney on Twitter.
Yeah.
All right. We'll catch you soon.
All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's see. That reminds me, I threw a link into this too as we begin to wrap things up. I wondered if you guys had seen that, you know, more and more you see sort of faux identities for celebrities on services like Twitter, and that people are actually starting to set them up for law firms, which I thought was pretty funny. There's an Orrick Harrington fake identity that someone is having some good fun with on Twitter.
Right, complaining about the summer associates.
Yes. So, and you know, the legal twist to that is, of course, you know, a business could take umbrage to the fact that both its trademarks perhaps are being used and that it possibly is being defamed. So,
well, good thing we've had, you know, however, what, 15 years now to see how the law has developed when it comes to cyber squatting. So I think a lot of those principles would apply there.
Yeah, but, you know, and this is where I'd love to have Marty on the show. Is it cyber squatting to, you know, you're not taking a domain, you're taking, I don't know if the technical word is a subdomain or a...
Right. You're part of it. The most you're doing is just creating a URL. And yeah. It certainly wouldn't be a domain name.
Right.
Out there. But it's more than that. You know, it's an identity. It's a, yeah, I mean, there are some elements or some components in there as well. But, you know, I think some of the principles, you know, in as much as domain name law is, you know, derived from and really kind of is nestled within trademark law, you know, you would have a lot of those types of arguments that you could make there and principles you could draw from. There are other things too, you know, I mean, fraud, misrepresentation, you know, defamation, perhaps false light, invasion of privacy. I don't know. You know, you could get really creative in some of this stuff. All I know is that I set up an account on Twitter this morning with the username Henshaw, which is my firm. So,
very smart.
I was precipitated from that. So if anybody wants to follow my firm, nobody exactly knows about it yet.
Well, you better start tweeting for them then.
Right. I'll think of something insightful to say about how wonderful we are.
So it's twitter.com/Henshaw.
Yes, Hinshaw. I have no plans to put any content there. It's mainly a defensive thing, I guess.
Well, then you can be just like Skadden, which has done the same thing.
Right. Yeah. As long as we're not, which was at work that you said that was that had the summer associates. I just remember reading the article. I couldn't remember the name of the firm.
So. Yeah, I know it was Orrick. Let me pull it up here real quick.
I love that.
Twitter.com/Orrick, O-R-R-I-C-K. And it, you know, who knows what fictional, they've only got like 4 or 5 posts, but the poster is, you know, creating some sort of fictional attorney identity for themselves. And the most current post, which was a month ago, so who knows, maybe someone got in trouble over this, says, fair, Orrick doesn't allow the Summers to party with me ever since I made all those dude Summers come to my house for a hot dog party.
So. That's great. What was his name? Jeremy? I forget his last name.
Blockman.
Who wrote The Anonymous Lawyer. Yeah. That'd be a great avenue for some character like that.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So. A little more subtle representation of one's manifestation of somebody's persona there.
Yes. And have you guys been following this sort of strange migration, transformation off of Twitter to Friend Feed and Identica, and this sentiment that all of these services need to unify in some way? I don't know. It's causing me more confusion than anything else. But no.
Well, I haven't. I've used Friend Feed some. You know, I mean, I put some of my content through there. You know, my Flickr photo stream and my delicious tags and you know, of course, Twitter and my blog post and everything like that. And, you know, I suspect, you know, I mean, I have a few, you know, friends on friend feed, so I suspect that they might find it useful to the extent anything that I put out there might be useful. But as for me, you know, as a consumer of media or, you know, content through, for example, friend feed, I find it to be quite overwhelming. You know, I mean, I subscribe to the feed of, you know, my friend feed friends, jeez, word salad there. You know, in Google Reader, and I wake up in the morning and I have, you know, 750 new items. So that really has a way of, you know, wearing one down psychologically.
I don't even look at my unread. I mean, I don't look at how many unread items I have in Google Reader anymore. It just, I have to block that.
And, you know, when I do, you know, actually get into some of the content that my friends are running through friend feed, I need to, you know, set some time or, you know, do it in a different mode than what I would of just going and checking my feeds, because, you know, every single thing is potentially something that's interesting. I mean, if they've chosen to share it and run it through there, it's because they find it important or because they've actually created the content themselves. So you can't expect to just, you know, kind of browse through there if you're really looking to get something meaningful. You got to, you know, make some time. So yeah, you do see this, what you were talking about, you know, these calls for these things to be, you know, centralized or whatever. And so it's interesting to see how we're now in a phase of disintegration, you know, things like friend feed. And there was another one, I guess Shifter was one. I blogged about that a couple months ago. I was kind of complaining about their copyright practices. I guess they've shaped up a little bit, but, you know, we see this disintegration. And
what did Shifter do that you were complaining about?
Well, they would allow, well, first of all, they were just republishing RSS feeds wholesale without, I guess they might have been linking back to the original content, but it really just seemed to cross line in as much as they were publishing, you know, full feeds in another place on the internet, which has search engine optimization problems, and also just kind of made me a little weary as a content producer, as a publisher. But another thing that a lot of social media enthusiasts were upset about, I forget exactly who it was. I know Lewis Grates tends to be was kind of a fan of Shifter. This is all back a few months ago. But another problem that social media enthusiasts has was that it was taking the conversation away from the domain, so to speak, of the publisher, because you could have these threads of comments on your content that resided in other places. For example, on the Shifter site. So there was this problem that Brian Solis identified when he said that, you know, the conversation has left the building.
Right.
And so much of social media and the sensibilities of a publisher depends on, you know, having not necessarily having control over, but being a part of the community that develops around your content. And when it starts splintering off onto places like Shifter or, you know, in the other sites where that allow comments to take their own and, you know, threads to take their own life, independent of any direct involvement of the independent of any supervision by the content producer, that's problematic, and it to a certain extent diminishes that sense of community that's developing around content.
Right. Not to mention the fact that a lot of people like to be able to track their users, you know, simply for volume reasons, to be able to sell advertising, or even to get more fine grained with it. And Colette, you no doubt remember the podjacking scandal a few years ago, where podcast RSS feeds were sort of appearing in multiples of places, and podcasters got up in arms about that. I see a lot of that happening with a lot of different kinds of feeds now, where someone will generate their own feed independent of a site's feed and offer it out, so that, you know, that's one way of subscribing to, say, either of your blogs, but you guys might not even know that that exists.
Yes, you might be perceptive and notice, you know, some click-throughs whenever there is the generosity of the secondary publisher to put some links.
But, right.
Yeah, Colette, what do you remember about podjacking? I remember we thought the world was going to come to an end.
Yeah, Evan and I were actually on opposite sides of that matter. That's how I met Evan. So it was an interesting thing. We settled. I haven't heard of any other podjacking. So
yeah. I think sensibilities have changed since then. You know, I don't know. Maybe the, you know, I won't mention your client by name because, you know, it's just how bygones be bygones. But I don't know if publishers are as focused on things like that anymore because of this disintegration that we're talking about. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out.
Yeah, but I think you need to opt into allowing others to create wholesale other feeds for your content. I mean, I think you have I don't know. I still think that it's the analogy I think of is as a bridge over some water or some other kind of space, in this case, cyberspace, connecting the person publishing the content to their readers. And they should be able to, readers or listeners or viewers, and they should be able to, you know, control that link. And if you build up an audience at one link and you find out unexpectedly that somebody's created a competing link, and that's not, I mean, there's, I don't want to get into the details of our case that we litigated, but we didn't even actually end up having to litigate. We settled. But, you know, this is funny because as much as I'm on the side of free speech and people being able to say whatever they want and push everything out, and that's why I think blogging and all of this new media is really exciting. I also think very strongly that people have a right to control all of the copyrights in their work, and this doesn't actually, like, the bridge you take to get to my content, if I only post it in one place, you know, that bridge isn't like protected by copyright. I don't know that that's the right area of law that governs that, but I think there's some other sort of,
well, I don't think copyright law has ever considered whether you have an exclusive right to publish an RSS feed that contains your material. I mean, we just haven't gotten there.
Right.
No. I mean, we have some case law. Was it the Field versus Google case that talks about the question of whether there's an implied license to just put content on the web in a web page? And, you know, the court held that, you know, if you know how to put a robots.txt exclusion file in there and choose not to do it, then, you know, that still doesn't give you the right to claim that there was infringement because you've given the implied license to go out there and let the Google search engine cache your content. So I think that's the closest thing I can think of.
Right.
So it would depend, I think, technologically. And of course, you know, one of the hallmarks of an implied license is, you know, the intent of the publisher. So if you can, I've haven't kept up on the latest and greatest trends when it comes to XML technology and, you know, how RSS feeds work. But, you know, if you can somehow make your feed so that it can't be appropriated or put into some other feed or, you know, copied wholesale, and you know how to do that and decide not to do it, perhaps that would be a factual circumstance where you could demonstrate that you have given an implied license, but it seems pretty far-fetched and imaginary to me.
I think it's interesting. You can also, in some cases in your feed, include the type of license you're offering your RSS feed under. And if the other party who decides to repost it ignores that instruction, I mean, there's a case where the secondary publisher might, you know, that's a fact situation where the secondary publisher might be more likely liable. I don't know.
Right. But are you licensing the feed or the content that's going into the feed?
Is there a difference?
I think there is. I mean, I don't know if you could license. I don't know if you could copyright a feed. You know, is that an actual copyrightable work?
It's an address. I don't know.
Well, sure. I mean, it could be the selection and the arrangement of the things that you decide to put into it. I mean, I think you could get a copyright on a feed of, like, say, for example, you just go browse the web and, you know, favorite items on Google Reader, you know, your selection and your arrangement, you know, I think in and of itself could be a copyrightable work. And there's some case law to support that. I think it's a case called, I think it's called XPNet versus Ben's Bargains. You know, one of the publishers, I can't remember who the parties were, but I know that one of the parties, and it was held to be copyrightable subject matter, would just go through and select good deals. You know, like there's a digital camera on sale at Circuit City for $79.99, and the next one would be, you know, Mont Blanc pens on sale for $129. You know, he would just have his site was just comprised of these deals. So in as much as, you know, that selection or arrangement of disparate elements could be copyrightable, it seems like your feed could be copyrightable, even though you're not getting a copyright or could not claim copyright on the individual, elements that comprise it.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of Google Reader, did you guys see that they fixed their privacy problem They had a couple, and I'm sure that these two things are related because they also announced that they were actually going to start doing things of a commercial nature or a promotable nature with people's shared items. So the first piece that Steve Gilmore has been ranting about for months now finally got itself fixed, thanks in part, I think, to Kevin Marks at Google and others there, I'm sure, where your shared items on Google were in Google Reader were in an unguessable sort of URL. If you had an expectation that you were going to share your shared items with only, you know, a few select people, you had some assurance that that was the limited universe of people who would see it, even though they were called shared items and Google described them as a public web page, etc. What Google did at first was made it so that everyone in your Gmail contacts list could see your shared items in Google Reader. And didn't give you any fine-grained controls over that. That's what they just fixed in the last week or so. You can now go into your sharing settings in Google Reader and decide who of your contacts you want to be seeing your shared items, or if you just want to broadcast them out to the world. So it's nice that they put that control in. And I think they had to do it because they just announced this political page of shared items for Google Reader. They're highlighting the Obama and the McCain campaigns. So people from the campaigns are putting things in using Google Reader, sharing them, annotating them, which is interesting in its own right. And then they're just so it's not entirely, the two polarized spin zones. They've got a host of political journalists that they're also inviting to participate in that, and they're making their shared items available as well, including Arianna Huffington and others. You can see where Google's going with this. The most compelling thing about Google Reader to me has always been being able to read other people's shared items. So,
yeah, you know, that really has changed the way that I read feeds as well. I mean, it's good to have a mechanism like that where items are vetted for you, and so you don't have to go through and, you know, read every of the 20 posts that TechDirt puts up every day. I can rely on some of my friends to, you know, put something or, you know, highlight something interesting. And even Twitter has affected my feed reading habits too, you know, in as much as, you know, people I follow on Twitter will link to something interesting. And
I don't see the even in that sentence. I mean, to me, it's the same thing that you know, they're acting as a filter in either instance.
Right. Yeah. It's a principle, I guess, you know, that I'm describing here.
Yeah.
And it's just good to see tools that enable that to be taken care of. I just, you know, as far as Google and privacy, I just feel so much better that there's a link to the privacy policy now on the
front page. Yes. They actually made that fit. Oh, they've only got about 6 dozen privacy policies that apply to their various properties. So,
right,
still you've got a world of complication after you click that link.
Oh, sure, and when the whole model is based on, you know, gathering information and linking seekers of information with that information, it's just, you know, privacy is definitely a challenging and thorny issue. It'll all work out.
Right. So you can see that the next step they're going to take with this Google Reader shared items highlighting strategy is they'll get, I forget what their actual terminology for the politics one is. It's something like power thinkers. Mm-hmm. So they're going to try and anoint, you know, who are the people whose shared items you should be following in various fields of inquiry. So right. I'm going to recommend both of you and Ernie for their legal page because I know, you know, I read your shared items now and they're great. So,
oh, thanks. It'd be interesting to see, you know, within Google how they are, you know, assigning tech support people to the servers that, you know, host the Obama-based content and the McCain-based content. I'm sure that it's completely even.
It would have to be, don't you think?
Right, of course. Google has never, you know, expressed any preference one way or the other ever before. So anyway, I'm just talking.
All right, guys. Well, I think we're just about ready to adjourn. But for folks interested in following up after the show, you can find Evan at internetcases.com and at twitter.com/internetcases.
Yes, that's me.
That's you. And also now at twitter.com/Hinshaw, we're going to make you start posting on behalf of your firm and get you into that can of worms.
Right. You know, maybe it can just be something between us here. I'll put out some tweets and we'll just see how long it takes somebody in marketing to notice.
Good. This will be our little twill experiment.
Right. Right.
But keep us surprised. And Colette, you can find at vogellaw.com, VogelElaw.com.
Yes.
And also your Colette on Twitter, is that right?
Yes. I've started to try and use Twitter again.
I noticed.
So I haven't had much to add to your conversation on that. I just still don't really understand what to put out into my feed. That's my biggest thing. It's like, I don't know. I'm watching the Olympics. Okay. You know, or I just read something. I'm like, why do people want to hear that? But anyway, so I'm trying. I'm playing around with it. I'm following some people. It's been fun. But yeah, that's my Twitter ID. And I also have my podcast at rulesfortherevolution.com.
That's right.
Which is very infrequent, but hopefully still relevant to some people.
Hey, you can't be more infrequent than we are.
No. Oh, yes, I can.
Great. Thank you so much, you guys. And we'll see you very soon.
All right. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.